Welcome, friends and strangers, to Spider on the Web number 51. That's right, 51. Brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. As we speak, I am packing for my trip to the Vancouver Island Music Fest in Courtenay, BC, where I'll be spending this weekend emceeing and performing with assistance from Jeannie and from Todd Butler. So let's open this week with some music by the man who has been running Music Fest superbly since the year dot, Mr. Doug Cox, a track from his album Bone, Bottle, Brass, or Steel. This is Musta Nada Gotta Lada. Take it, Doug.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Learn more about Doug Cox at www.dougcox.org. And you can learn about the Vancouver Island Music Fest at www.islandmusicfest.com. If I was to read the list of all this year's performers at top speed, it would take me the rest of this podcast, but you should know that some of the headliners include the Wailers, Taj Mahal, Earl Scruggs with Family and Friends, Sparrow Quartet with Bella Fleck and Abigail Washburn, Jerry Douglas, Michael Friedman, and the great Valdi. That's just some of the highlights. Check out islandmusicfest.com for the rest. The one thing I'll tell you is that every time I go to a music fest, I end up getting turned on to at least five really terrific new performers I didn't know, never heard of before, that go on my must-buy-on-site list. I'm sure it's going to happen again this year. Last time around, for instance, I scored Daryl Scott and Alex Cuba and the great Johnny Boutte of New Orleans, so I can't wait for this festival. Now, by the way, if you were frightened off by the ghastly audio quality of last week's podcast, Spider on the Web number 51, my apologies. The horse responsible has been man-whipped. It was subsequently re-recorded with the usual software and reposted or recast or whatever the term is, and can be found in the same pod where you found this one now, either the iTunes store or SpiderRobinson.com. What with that and six things in another, I forgot to mention that last Monday, July 7th, was Robert A. Heinlein's 101st birthday. A belated happy birthday, Robert. To commemorate that event, I am going to play you now the audio of a presentation I gave at Moses Zneimer's Idea City 06 conference in Toronto, just after Variable Star was released, since it references Robert so heavily. For those of you who are American, Moses Zneimer basically single-handedly invented Canadian cable TV. Every Canadian cable channel that does not suck was started by him or ripped off by somebody from an idea of his. And once a year in June in Toronto, he gets together 50 professional thinkers, treats them lavishly, and has them share a year's worth of their best ideas with each other and with about 500 civilians who pay a fortune to be there. They just made large sections of this year's Idea City 08 available online for the very first time this past June, and they will be doing so from now on. So please don't miss it. See www.ideacityonline.com for details. Anyway, here I am in Toronto in 2006 telling a room full of strangers how I got my dream back. Make it go down, Moses.
The end. This is our last cluster of speakers, yes, indeed. And in wanting to end with a big flourish, and given what we'd heard today, I thought, well, the religion of science fiction, of course. Let's look way out into the future. And immediately I thought about Spider Robinson. And I thought of John Howe, the artist extraordinaire who helped visualize Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. Well, Spider, who's a well-known author about sci-fi, and John, who's a visualizer of sci-fi, apparently neither of them want to talk about that. That's what I've just been told, and I have one other complaint. There's a fair amount of preparation that goes into presenting the speakers in the fashion that they deserve, and so I look forward to the few days remaining before the conference to kind of really dig in and read the books and listen to the CDs. And as I opened up the file that was sent to me by my office, out tumbled this volume. It's an advanced, uncorrected proof of Variable Star and a seriously dirty trick on the part of Spider Robinson. This is an astonishing thing. It's generally agreed that the premier science fiction writer of the recent era, now deceased, was Robert Heinlein. You all know him. We've all read Stranger in a Strange Land. We've grokked the meaning of his work. Well, it turns out that when his estate was rummaging through his papers, they found an incomplete manuscript, notes for a novel in progress, and it's a measure of the standing of Spider Robinson that the estate of Robert Heinlein asked him to complete is novel. When will it be out?
September.
In September. So guess what I was doing at 4 o'clock this morning? And at 4 o'clock yesterday morning and the day before, it's magnetic. I've gone that far, and mercifully on Sunday or Monday I will get to finish it properly.
You're almost up to the good part.
Yeah. So here's what I can figure out from what these two guys have told me, and it sort of makes sense to me. You know, we all admire the thing we can't do, right? So the jocks want to be rock stars, the rock stars want to sing opera, the opera singers want to be models, and the sci-fi writer wants to be a singer-songwriter. So come on up here, Spider Robinson, singer-songwriter.
Thank you for your sympathy. Of course, thanks to Moses and Marika and Nancy and all the people without whom all this would not have been necessary. I'm here to tell you today how I got my dream back, and 20 minutes doesn't leave me much time, so pardon me if I talk fast. I got my dream in the first place in November of 1954 on my sixth birthday. My mother brought me to a place called the Plainview Old Bethpage Public Library, pushed me in the door and said, tell them to give you a book. And inside there, a woman whose name I only this year learned, it was Ruth Siegel. God bless you, Ruth. Ruth Siegel handed me a copy of a book called Rocket Ship Galileo by Robert A. Heinlein and handed my whole life to me. Robert led me to science fiction. Science fiction led me to science, which led me to space, to the vision of man in space. And lo and behold, along about the same time, here came Disney and Wernher von Braun with wonderful graphics to show us men on the moon, men traveling to the stars. And I got real excited, and for the next 15 years or so, everything was great. Trust me, in 1954, there was not one human being anywhere on the face of the planet Earth who honestly believed there would be footprints on the moon in as little as 15 years. We accomplished unbelievable miracles in a short time, and then, at the very peak of success, just as we were on the verge of opening up the solar system, that rat bastard Richard Nixon, as he was shaking the hands of Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins, was using his other hand to cut NASA's budget. And every president since has done the same thing. Oh, you guys can make bricks without straw? Hey, let's see how you do without clay. It's getting ugly these days. The last time I was on the stage in 2002, I bemoaned the fact that science fiction readership was in decline, and consequently, there wasn't anything on the TV news to remind them of us. Science fiction readership and publisher support are at their lowest levels in a long time. And just as the future is opening up, everyone seems to want to stampede into the past. And the folks who had their eyes on the stars now seem to have their eyes on the movie stars. I think I started to get depressed when Robert Heinlein had to leave the party in 1988. But when I really got depressed was in the early 90s, the first time I was toastmaster of a world science fiction convention, happened to be in Orlando, Florida. And after that convention, I rented a car and drove down the coast for the purpose of watching a space shuttle launch. It was a profoundly moving experience I've written about more than once, but the part I always leave out of the story is the part where my wife Jeannie and I are staring out the windows of a tour bus at a Saturn booster, one of the two left on Earth, the mighty engines that put men on the moon, lying on its side on the ground in the rain, rusting away. You couldn't build a new Saturn today if you wanted to. They threw out the specs and the plans in order to save storage space. Well, watching the space shuttle come wheeling out of a giant hangar that was built for a Saturn booster was very much like watching a small child walk out the door of a very large cathedral. It just was kind of pitiful. Even then, in the 90s, man's maximum reach in space had dropped back from 250,000 miles to the lousy 200 or 300 miles that the shuttle could reach. Today, it's barely that, and the shuttle seems to be history in the making. I kept waiting and waiting year after year for someone to win the $10 million Ansari X Prize for private enterprise space exploitation, and year after year it kept not happening. Well, the second time I was a Worldcon Toastmaster was right here in Toronto in 2003, and I made a speech there bemoaning the fact that somehow we had failed to sell our fellow citizens our dream of man in space. Somehow our central vision just hadn't gone over, and they were all busy watching American Idol instead. But that same weekend, I helped to present the first ever Robert A. Heinlein Awards for fiction and nonfiction promoting manned spaceflight. It was a very interesting ceremony. At that dinner, I was shown a QuickTime movie of Robert himself being interviewed by Walter Cronkite on the day that Apollo 11
landed on the moon. He was so excited he could barely talk. He kept saying, "This is the greatest thing for mankind since the invention of fire." That was very inspirational. Then after, I learned of something even more impressive after that, the existence of something called the Heinlein Prize. Not the Heinlein Award, but the Heinlein Prize. This is intended to encourage commercial achievement in manned spaceflight, and while it is no X Prize, it's nothing to sneeze at either. It consists of $500,000 U.S. to be given out annually. Robert spent most of his life writing about exciting events in space. He left behind millions and left all of them to us to help realize his dream. That's how urgent he felt was the need for us to get off this stupid planet while we still can. But even that wasn't the most amazing thing that happened to me at that convention. The next day, there was a panel on rare, obscure discoveries in the Heinlein archives made by the archivists. And as Moses has already told you, one of them stepped forward and said, "We found this amazing thing, a complete, detailed, at least 7-page long outline for a Heinlein novel that he wrote in November 1955, 1 year after I picked up Rocket Ship Galileo. And it's 14 pages of index cards that he made handwritten notes on. It's all ready to go." And a woman in the back of the room, whose name I have since learned was Kate Gladstone, stood up and said, "You should get Spider Robinson to finish that book." And there was applause. Well, make a long story short, this September, Tor Books will bring out Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson, and I still can't say those words without a ridiculous thrill running up and down my spine. Put it up even higher. Working with my mentor's ghost sitting on my shoulder, making caustic comments as I typed, was one of the most amazing experiences in a lifetime that's been remarkably full of amazing experiences. In a very real sense, his spirit came to help me, and so did his friends and family and fans. His granddaughter, Dr. Amy Baxter, was kind enough to send me a pair of Robert's cufflinks to wear as I typed. His executor, Art Dula, the famous space attorney from Houston, gave me Robert's personal dictionary, lovingly hand-repaired at least a dozen times. Whenever I ran short of words writing this book, I had Robert Heinlein's personal box of words to dip into. There are no words to express how cool that feels. But when I first received the outline from Art, one of the first things I couldn't help but notice was the reason why the archivist had said an outline of at least 7 pages is because page 7 ends in the middle of a sentence. In mid-air, in mid-story. God knows how many more pages there were that are lost to history. And my first reaction was, joy! I not only write with Robert Heinlein, I get to pick the ending. My second reaction was, oi! What do I do for an ending? I stared at the wall for weeks, unable to think of an ending that seemed to me heavy enough for the first new Robert Heinlein novel in nearly 20 years. And as I was pondering and biting the inside of my cheek, I was playing iTunes on my PowerBook here. And at one point, iTunes finally finished playing Ray Charles and defaulted to the next artist in line, Robert A. Heinlein. It happened someone gave me a few brief radio clips from an interview that Robert did in Butler, Missouri on Robert Heinlein Day in 1980. And the 3 or 4 sentences that he spoke next gave me the ending of my book. With any luck at all, you'll hear them now.
"We need to have as many baskets for our eggs as possible. Even if we don't manage to ruin this planet ourselves, natural disasters or changes or even changes in our star could make it impossible to live on this planet. My opinions as to the future of mankind are hedged in by this statement. I think it is necessary for the human race to establish colonies off this planet. This is strictly local patriotism, but I want my race, the human race, to go on. And to do so, they must spread out through the universe."
Well, thank you, Robert, for giving me my ending. Once I realized this had to be a book about why space travel is not merely desirable, but urgently necessary to the survival of our species, everything else fell into place and the words began to flow. I don't want to get spooky here, but I felt Robert's presence almost physically, very powerfully every day. The one time I scared the hell out of my wife was when she saw me leaving the house bringing a vacuum cleaner out to my office. Jeannie has been forbidden to clean in that office since I moved into it 8 years ago, but Robert Heinlein, he's an Annapolis graduate. He wasn't going to work in that pigsty. I had to swamp the place out. And the more I wrote about travel to a star 85 light years away, The more I regain my own faith, my own lifelong conviction and hope and dream and prayer that one day my grandchildren will do just that, because it is in the nature of monkeys to keep on climbing out of sheer curiosity until we reach the topmost branch. And meanwhile, while I was writing the book, Paul Allen and Richard Branson and Burt Rutan were winning the $10 million XPRIZE for successful orbital flight and return, which they did back in October 2004, and announcing plans to create an entire fleet of ships to take you into orbit for space tourism, Branson's Virgin Galactic Enterprises. And none of the XPRIZE losers have quit either. They're all still out there looking for funding. And just a few weeks ago, finally, the first ever Heinlein Prize, $500,000 U.S., was awarded to Dr. Peter Diamandis, who was himself one of the founders of the XPRIZE. All around the world, a multi-trillion dollar industry is in the process of birthing itself and establishing itself and shaping its future and yours. It has been all along, while science fiction readership has been bleeding off to Lord of the Rings movies, because the smart money doesn't read a lot of fiction. The smart money reads bottom lines, and space's bottom line looks very good. Now, I don't have enough time to give you the proof of that, but if you go to www.NSS.com, the National Space Society, they'll give you about all the information you need, and from there Google can get you the rest. All I'm doing is contributing whatever, what little I can. Half of whatever profits are realized from Variable Star go right off to the top to the Heinlein estate, specifically to keep that Heinlein prize fund topped off, so that each year Art Dula can continue to hand out a half a megabuck check to some pioneer of commercial manned spaceflight in the hope that Robert's dream will be realized. It had better be. This is our last wake-up call. It is now or never. We get no more chances after this next one. This Earth is not enough. It can never be enough. We bust out now or we die here after we finish gnawing the place bare. Sir Stephen Hawking said it just last week, issued a press release, said we must get off this ball of mud and reach the stars or we will die. No third choice. The songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil probably summed it up over 30 years ago. We got to get out of this place, or it's the last thing we'll never do. We're running out of oil, and the alternative technologies do not cut it, and they will not cut it by the time the oil is gone. But in space is 8 times the solar power found in the hottest desert in Nevada, working 24/7, 365, waiting to be caught. We can put cheap, flimsy solar collectors in orbit, giant spider webs invisible to the ground that can catch that power and beam it down so safely, I'll be willing to live in a house built underneath one of the Rectana farms that receives the energy. It might be even better to place our solar panels on the moon and use a fraction of the power to finally start colonizing the place, because the moon happens to be covered with something wonderful called helium-3. I haven't got time to tell you why helium-3 is so wonderful. It's a long story, but trust me, it's the secret to the best possible fusion power. Fusion power that doesn't involve radioactivity or radioactive waste of any kind. The moon is the only body in the inner solar system that's covered with the stuff, and it's just lying on the ground waiting for you to come along with a shovel and a bucket. They've been working on fusion power for a long time, and eventually we are going to get it. Now, with orbital and or lunar sun power, we can limp along until we perfect helium-3 fusion. Without them, the lights are all going to start to go out sometime in the next 50 years. There's damn little fossil fuel left, and at present it takes a hell of a lot of it to break free of Earth's gravity and get into orbit. The window is beginning to close. If we break free to space now, it'll start to rain soup. Forget about the free power. Think about free metal. Free minerals. God obligingly took a giant rock collection of everything you could possibly want to build a technological civilization, broke it up into bite-sized pieces, and hung it on skyhooks. It's called the asteroid belt. Right now, we're smart enough to get to the asteroid belt. Right now, we can build robots smart enough to find the good asteroids, the ones full of good ores, and strap motors on them and kick them back this way. And once that happens, all we got to do is wait. Wait as long as it takes for the soup to fall into our bucket. But none of this is going to happen unless we can get into space on a regular basis. And for that, we need people to want to go there. We need people to want to live there and work there and raise their families there, and that's where people like me come in. We're trying to make you dream of space, to realize how cool it's going to be to live there in a place where your back never hurts and your knees never go and your shoulders are never bowed and your feet never hurt, where your heart has vastly less work to do 24/7, where there are no cripples, where there are no short people, where even parents and their children can relate at eye level for the first time. Here's the point I'm hoping will finally sell people on space tourism. When you get out of our gravity field, all the fluids in your body redistribute. And one of the effects is your legs get slimmer and your bust gets larger. Does that do it for you? But the one that sells it to me is that space is the place where everyone can fly. My wife is a choreographer, a retired modern dancer. She choreographed over 30 original works during the 8 years that she ran Nova Dance Theater in Halifax. We wrote 3 books together called The Star Dance Trilogy about zero-gravity dance, about how beautiful and graceful and luxurious an environment space can be. By coincidence, it happens that entire trilogy is about to be republished for the first time in a single hardcover volume the same month Variable Star comes out, so that takes care of all your Christmas money. As a result of our trilogy, Jeannie very nearly got to go herself. Someone saw her dance at a science fiction convention, a dance involving some very crudely simulated zero-G dance, and signed her up for the Civilian and Space Program to dance in orbit, to show people there's more to space than jocks in spacesuits. Unfortunately, the first civilian they sent up, they killed, and that was the end of the Civilian and Space Program for our lifetimes. Well, after the Heinlein Awards banquet in Toronto in 2003, a conversation turned to the fact that Robert's centennial is coming up. On July 7th, 2007, the man will be 100 years old. And the discussion turned to, what should we do to celebrate this? What kind of party would Robert like thrown for his 100th birthday? And a man named Dr. John Barnstead of Dalhousie University in Halifax said, well, Robert and Virginia Heinlein were both fierce, passionate defenders of future arts, in particular the arts in space. I think what they'd really love to see is a zero-gravity dance premiered at their party. And he turned to my wife and he handed her a check out of his own pants for seed money. Well, she is in the process of making that film now with Michael Lennick, the Ontario director who spoke to you from this very stage a couple of days ago, and a crew so brilliant I wish I had time to tell you about all of them, but I don't. So the short answer is go to my website, spiderrobinson.com, and click on the Stardance Project link, and you'll find out everything you want to know. Part of Jeannie's reason for making this film is to try and help show ordinary people, investors and taxpayers and tourists, that space is a human place, is a beautiful place, is a place where art can be made of a magic found nowhere else, a place of grace and majesty and awesome beauty. Why tell them this? Well, one of the most important images that Jeannie and I came up with for our Stardance trilogy was the image of the Earth as a womb. Our own daughter was very nearly a 10-month-old baby. When she reached 9 months, she apparently took a look at the outside world and said, I ain't going. Decided to sit tight. And you could sympathize with their decision, but it was not a wise one. Those last 3 weeks of Jeannie's pregnancy, the doctors were very concerned because the little fetus in there had begun to do what all fetuses do best, excrete, and was in the process of drowning itself in its own waste products. They were very concerned that they would need to induce birth, and in the end, eventually they did. Well, that's what's happening to the planet Earth. The Earth is a womb, and it is long past time for us to birth, and we are killing ourselves in the pollution of our own waste products, and if we do not birth soon, we will die of cowardice. Someone is going into space soon, or we're all screwed. Why not us, Canadians? It would be nice if the working language of space enterprise turned out to be English, the language of Robert Heinlein and most of his fellow pioneers, and the Americans at the moment are both too dumb and too broke, having just poured $7 trillion into a hole in the sand to preserve a few years' oil. Space is something Canada is good at, something we have a tradition of excellence at. They could never have gotten Apollo 11 to the moon in the first place without the boys and girls they hijacked from the Avro Arrow on us. All we need to do is to want to do it, and all I can do is try to make as many as possible of you want it by telling you how cool it's going to be. Well, fortunately, Robert Heinlein is not the only big gun I have helping me this time. As I was working on Variable Star, I got a fan letter from a stranger I didn't know in California, a man who said, I'm a big fan of your works. I just finished your latest novel and loved it. I love everything you write. Signed, David Crosby. I think my first reply was, hymen, 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 hymen. And when I was coherent enough to talk, we got talking, and I discovered first off that David, like me, is a major, massive Robert Heinlein nut, has read everything he's ever written and loves him. And when he heard that I was working on a book with Robert Heinlein, his eyes bugged out, and he wanted to know, was there any way he could help, anything he could do to help the process along? Well, I said, funny you should mention that, David. I've written some song lyrics into chapter one of the book, and I don't have a tune. I got your back, he said, and I'm going to try and play you a working version of it now. Now, you must understand we're not done. Cross isn't happy with the chorus entirely. He wants to revamp it a little bit, and I guess I don't blame him. But this is a work in progress. He has signed off on the verses, and I'm going to try and render it for you now if I can just get Robert's cufflink off so that it doesn't keep slapping against the guitar. There we go. The song is called On the Way to the Stars.
The reason we're going to Mars is we know it's a step on the road to the stars. It's the reason we hang out in bars, don't you know? 'Cause we can't find our way to the stars. I could bear all these losses of ours if I knew we would meet again out in the stars. On the way to the stars, every molecule in you was born in the heart of a star. On the way to the stars, in the night of the light that will help you to know where you are. Yes, they are from so far. It's the reason we came from the mud, don't you know? 'Cause we wanted to climb to the stars. And in our flesh and our blood and our bone, we all know we were meant to return to the stars. Ask anyone which way is God, and you know he will probably point to the stars. On the way to the stars, every molecule in you was born in the heart of a star. On the way to the stars, in the night there's a light that will help you to know where you are. Yes, they are from so far. Well, I can't prove it so, but I'm certain I know our ancestors came from the stars. And it would not be so lonely to die if I knew I had died on the way to the stars. And if we do our part and follow our heart, our children will live in the stars. Yes, our children will dance in the stars.
Thank you for your sympathy. Thank you.
Speaking of Robert, reminds me to tell you that the Easton Press, which puts out those superb leather-bound editions of classics of science fiction, and sometimes first editions signed, has just released their leather-bound edition of Starship Troopers by Robert A. Heinlein. It's just an incredibly gorgeous volume, the usual acid-free paper, the hand-sewn binding with the bookmark built in. One of its other features, however, is an introduction by someone named Robinson, which I propose to read to you now. Introduction. 50 years after it provoked the entire editorial board of Scribner's into firing Robert A. Heinlein, then won him his second Hugo Award, and made a fortune for Putnam, people are still so determined to argue about Starship Troopers that in any given year I derive nearly as much healthy exercise from staying out of the fight as I would have expended in it. This enrages just as many fools, and frees up time for more important things like rubbing my cat or scratching my wife. To this day, despite gallons of ink and bile, the book remains what it was from the start, all but impossible to put down. An unforgettable story on a vast canvas, featuring awesome technology and a provocative message that makes the reader question basic assumptions. Exactly what I read science fiction for. I read it first in magazine serialization in The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction as an 11-year-old boy just beginning to grow hair in strange places. I read it again in Berkeley paperback as a 20-year-old just after the summer of love, growing hair everywhere. I reread it and all his work, most recently 4 years ago, before beginning Variable Star, and to my astonishment, my hair has continued to find odd new places to grow, albeit grayer. I expect I'll read Starship Troopers at least once more before I finally emigrate to the Belt, a featureless ball of white hair, happily married to a freefall dancer. It has thrilled, stimulated, provoked, and instructed, and challenged me just as much every time, and each time in different ways, for different reasons. Can a novel do more? How many do as much? Noted Heinlein student James Gifford points out that the narrative never transcends the viewpoint of one self-admittedly ignorant and insulated young man in a powered suit, far from home. Juan Rico never discusses any aspect of government, civic function, or politics except the franchise. We get no other definition of citizen, no clue what powers, freedoms, guarantees, or rights might be available to non-citizens, the majority, save the strong hints that they are quite prosperous and totally multicultural without perceptible friction. Gifford writes, quote, "Because the parts that are there are so strongly stated and so polarizing in concept and tone, and because the parts that aren't there are so vast, each reader has to bring in his or her own baggage to fill out the tale and the context. A key part of the baggage, perhaps the key part, is the reader's attitude towards Robert Heinlein himself." Unquote. And none of us knows as much about Robert as we think we do. Certainly not me. We were friends, by no means close friends. We were in the same room less than half a dozen times. But we talked a lot over the years, by phone, letter, and finally email. We agreed on many things, and to our mutual delight, we had a few ongoing debates still in progress when he had to leave, which I've done my poor best to hold up both ends of ever since. My copy of Expanded Universe is inscribed "To Genie and Spider with Love," and that is not a word he tossed around. I like to think I knew him. But I was floored a few years ago when William H. Patterson, Jr., his archivist biographer and editor of the Heinlein Journal, told me Robert's record collection had included all the Jefferson Airplane albums. Yes, including Volunteers, with lyrics like "Up the Revolution" and "Up Against the Wall, Motherfuckers." Apparently, he had a thing for Gracie Slick. Who could have imagined? If he were alive today, who knows what would be on Robert's iPod Touch? Starship Trooper by Yes? CSNY's new DVD? Now that I think of it, Gracie was the first to record Triad, the then-scandalous David Crosby song inspired by Robert's fiction, on an airplane album. That might be what first brought her and them to his attention. Well, that's only part of why I've enjoyed rereading Starship Troopers every few decades. The curious fact that each time I find different parts of its underlying argument disturbing, or pleasing, or confusing than I did last time. And thus, learn useful things about the baggage I'm carrying around at the moment. But I always learn it the way Johnny Rico learns combat, as fast as I can and with scattered attention. Each time I as am spellbound as an 11-year-old again, by the plight of a strong, dumb, brave young man who wakes up and sees interstellar genocide coming like a slow-motion avalanche and decides it's up to him to learn how to fight for his race. By which I do not mean Filipinos, which we learn is his heritage only 5 pages before the end, but human beings. You can hear Robert state his point specifically in his own voice near the end of the free podcast Spider on the Web number 18. "This is strictly local patriotism, but I want my race, the human race, to go on." That is what Starship Troopers glamorizes, what Colonel Dubois teaches. Not militarism or brutality or joy in killing. Not nationalism, racism, or holy war. Pride in being a human being. An acceptance of the duty of survival, even at the cost of sacrifice. Standing up for whatever you perceive to be your kind until you fall. Paying for what you have been given, paying it forward. That is glorious and noble, Whether it happens at the level of one doomed urban neighborhood, a mighty nation on some particular planet, or a supercluster of galaxies. For this is what it means to be human, to persist. Angry nihilists, nearly always young, and most of the books, films, TV, and eco-journalism currently winning major prizes for clinically depressed old men, demand I admit the human race does not deserve to persist. I will concede the point the moment one of them names any other species, alive or extinct, with a single member that even momentarily wondered whether it deserved to live, let alone tried to change. When Eeyores tell me humans haven't become moral and compassionate fast enough, I ask who else since the planet coalesced and cooled has ever even tried. Robert took such delight in being contrary, and was so blinkin' good at it, that I venture to suggest not even his beloved Ginny, with whom I had a much longer and deeper correspondence, could have predicted with certainty what he would have had to say about the current situation in Iraq. But I've had more than one stranger too young to have met him lecture me on the subject. Most assume that since he once supported American involvement in a silly war in Vietnam, he would naturally feel the same about any future silly war, even if it wasn't required by a treaty. I doubt it, but the only solid evidence I have is Pandora's Box, a.k.a. Where To?, the famous 19 specific predictions of the future he made in 1950 and updated twice, the last time shortly before he died. I reread them for the first time in decades before tackling Variable Star. Prediction number 4, one of the first certainties that came to his mind, broke my heart. Quote, "It is utterly impossible that the United States will ever start a preventive war. We will fight only when attacked, either directly or in a territory we have guaranteed to defend." Unquote. 20 years after his death, the America Robert loved so deeply is something he would no longer recognize. For all we know from the text of Starship Troopers, the bug war may well have been blundered into, misconceived, unplanned, underfunded, administratively bungled, milked by profiteers, and or some combination thereof. Perhaps both races have been brilliantly manipulated into war by the skinnies, for profit or amusement. We are never given the name, description, location, or even the job title of mankind's mysterious chief executive. For all we're told, he or she may deserve power or not, might or might not be educated and wise enough to wield it. At book's end, we don't even have a clue how the war is going or what the government's popularity rating might be. Those things simply don't matter in a cap trooper's world, any more than they do or should for an American soldier in Iraq today. The one thing we and Lieutenant Rico do know is the chief executive who put him in his capsule and all of that person's staff will at some point have placed their personal lives and fortunes at serious risk for that society for at least 2 years, and will have demonstrated bravery and learned to listen to experts who tell them things they don't want to hear. Responsibility and duty will balance. Mobile infantry are not sent into battle in cut-rate, low-bid armor, nor instructed to torture themselves forever by torturing others today, nor tasked to do 15-month tours as crossing guards in a heavily armed lunatic asylum, and are never commanded by a civilian who would wear a military uniform as a costume for a fake photo op. None of that is really relevant to the novel, nor will whatever silly non-war happens to be going on the next time I reread it be relevant, in another half a century or so. I just pray it isn't the same one. Starship Troopers is not about politics or even about history and moral philosophy. It's about the future and moral philosophy. Whether there'll be a future for us, and yes, whether there should be one, rude as we are, and most of all, about ways we might live to improve it. It's about duty and courage and why the true cost of freedom can't be put on your grandchildren's credit cards. It's about dealing in facts rather than wishes, and not fudging the details out of laziness, the offense that got section leader Rico flogged. Most important, its storytelling so inspired and powerful that generations later, an endless series of progressively paler and lamer imitations are still selling briskly as movies, books, comics, and games. But like Tarzan, Mowgli, Frodo, or the Saint, Lieutenant Juan Rico, the original Sky Soldier, Robert's first name for the book, will outlast all the poor copies, and will, I believe, last longer even than Interstellar War itself, which Joe Haldeman reminds us can take nearly forever. One can hope. All right, I'm going to be going up on a stage this Saturday afternoon, armed only with a guitar. It will be, I believe, the second time I've performed in public in the last year. It'll also be about the fourth or maybe fifth time I've picked up my guitar in the last year. That's how busy it's been. And yet, you don't hear any terror in my voice. Why is that? Because I got backup. The great Todd Butler is going to ride shotgun with me, and that takes all fear from my heart. Let me give you an idea of what I'm talking about. You will recall the musical selection with which we opened this podcast, Musta Gotta Lotta Nada, or as it's correctly pronounced, Musta Nada Gotta Lotta. Well, here's that selfsame tune. Would you add Todd Butler to it? This from the album Live Blues by Doug Cox and Todd Butler, which you can learn more about at dougcox.org or toddbutler.com. Here you go, Musta Nada Gotta Lotta. I just want to take a quick minute to thank you folks once again for your subscriptions, your generous donations, and for buying my books. Now I gotta go throw some clothes in a suitcase and go to Doug's festival. Alright, to take us out of here is one more Doug Cox track, this time with three different gentlemen I met at his Vancouver Island Music Fest in the years past, and maybe this will give you an idea of what kind of eclectic cat Doug truly is. Here now are Doug Cox, Salil Bhatt on the Mohan Veena, Ram Kumar Mishra on the tablas, and Johnny Boutte of New Orleans on vocals, from their album Make a Better World, the title track.
We know was built on skills, but that alone it don't count. No, what out the sweat and toils of yours and mine, it would not be worth a dime. You gotta live and give, share and care, really put love in the air. When your neighbor's down, you ought to pick him up. Nobody can live in despair. And everybody let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody let's sing. Let freedom ring. Join hands, do your thing. Make a better world to live in. My Lord, everybody let's sing. Sing, sing, everybody let's sing. Let freedom ring. Join hands, do your thing. Make a better world of living. Society has no priority. We're all a part of the whole. Yes, whenever people shout, you gotta hear them out. Cause everybody got a good, good, beautiful soul. We gotta come together hand in hand. Really got to do our best. Oh Lord. Now, wouldn't it be a pleasant sight to see the world full of happiness? Everybody let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody let's sing. Let freedom ring. A joint hand, all pitch in. Make a better world to live in.
Please come back next week for Spider on the Web, number 52, my first birthday as a podcaster. See you then.